This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. Last week's Cadenza, my 500th program, had as guest the noted cultural historian, author, and presenter Joseph Horowitz, who has been for decades rethinking and presenting alternatives to the standard classical orchestra concert, most recently with his Washington, D.C.-based post-classical ensemble. One artist Joe has worked with and continues to work with on numerous projects is Kevin Dace, my guest today. Kevin has gained the international renown as one of this country's leading bass baritones. One of the most successful projects on which he has collaborated with Mr. Horowitz and the post-classical ensemble led by their music director, Ángel Gijordóñez, is called Dvorak and America. You're listening to my guest in William Arms Fischer's setting of the slow movement of Dvorak's New World Symphony, the Largo, with Fischer's text making it the beloved song Going Home. My guest has sung with many of the major orchestras in this country and abroad and has appeared on many recordings, also on stage in the Opera House, most notably the countless times he has performed the role of Porgy in Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. He has also worked to expand the repertoire for his demanding voice range, premiering many works by composers of our time, such as Dave Brubeck, Derek Bermel, Anthony Davis, and Hannibal Lacumba. He also loves to teach and find that next batch of singers, whether bass baritones or not, and his teaching ranges from Princeton University to the secondary education institution George School in Newtown, PA, where he and I met last week.
Oh. Just as a point of reference, last week's show was my 500th program. This show's in its 11th year. In all that time, I've only had one prior baritone, Nathan Gunn. And I've had numerous tenors, sopranos, altos, even a number of countertenors. So that makes you the first true bass baritone I've had on this program in 11 years.
That's quite a distinction. I appreciate that.
I'm just curious, when someone has this voice and they're at your level, is there a recognition of your peers? This isn't a huge group. Is it kind of a club mentality, either just in the U.S. or globally? Do you know each other and you sort of... This has to be a pretty close-knit group.
It's a pretty close-knit group. The thing is that they're actually kind of two different groups. Now, okay. I'm principally a concert singer.
Right.
I do opera maybe once or twice a season, but most of my work is in the concert hall with symphonic orchestras. And so on those occasions, I'm usually the bass. So I don't really work with a lot of my bass colleagues unless I'm doing an opera. And even then, it can kind of be limited to one or two basses. But we know each other and respect each other.
You sort of keep tabs of what you're all doing. I mean, it has to kind of work that way. I mean, is there a sense of competition or is there more sense of collegiality where we're in this together?
Well, to be perfectly honest, there is always that element of competition.
Okay.
We don't necessarily look at each other as any kind of threat, but, you know, you kind of can't help but observe what's happening with other colleagues and maybe that they're doing something that you might like to do. And I'd like to think occasionally they might be a little envious of what I might be doing. But in general, I think singers have a real collegial attitude with each other because we all know the struggles and we're rarely in the decision-making position in terms of casting and that kind of thing. So we empathize, but again, we do give into that green monster occasionally of jealousy.
I want to get to how you found your voice, but I want to stick with just the voice category here for one more question, because this voice, this bass voice, bass baritone voice, carries a presence with it. It just does, and there's a persona to it. How do you, once you know this is your voice, how do you find that? Because you can dominate the stage, you can demand from an audience in ways that some of the other voices, maybe the coloratura, can.
Yes.
But you can do that with this voice.
Well, thank you, David.
How do you find that?
Well, I kind of think that it's partially genetics. My dad was a wonderful orator, and he used to actually sing. In fact, some of my first experience hearing classical music was when we were stationed in Alaska. My dad was stationed on Fort Wainwright near Fairbanks, Alaska. And he would sing bass solos in Messiah. And very, very powerful personality he had. And really until he passed, very active in the church and would do various functions in service of the church. So I had him as a role model for my oratorial kind of experience and expression. My mom, I credit with kind of the softer side of my musicality, because she had this sweet, really lovely alto voice. And we had singing around our house all the time. My dad would mow the lawn and sing outside, you know, singing, "Thus saith the Lord for Messiah," and stuff like that. Of course, the neighbors kind of were a bit askance at that, but, you know, we were a musical family.
So you gave this away. You were, in a sense, a military brat, right?
I am totally a military brat, yes.
How do you come to settle that the voice is it rather than an instrument that you don't carry around with you? You didn't take up another... I mean, how did you settle on it's going to be the voice?
Well, it's almost as if it just came to me and I went with it. I started off studying piano here in New Jersey. My dad was stationed at Fort Dix and I worked with the music director at the chapel, the main chapel on Fort Dix, Jean Martin. She taught me piano and then encouraged me to go to a music camp, and the head of the music camp in Lebanon, New Jersey was Abraham Kaplan, great choral conductor. He prepared a lot of the choruses for Leonard Bernstein and the Camerata singers. And I went to this music camp, and here I see this incredibly expressive, dramatic Israeli conductor conducting Elijah, and I just thought, wow, what is this? You know, and so as I did further exploration, I realized, of course, this was an entire art form, and I had had that early exposure with Messiah and my dad singing prior to that, but to actually participate in singing in a masterwork by Mendelssohn that was, you know, a story that everyone could understand and get involved with was really was kind of the deciding factor.
Was there any decision you had to make to settle on quote-unquote classical music, concert, opera, recital music? Or, I mean, were you tempted to sing other genres? I mean, your parents were... I know your dad would sing Messiah Cutting the Lawn, but yes. your parents had a wide range of musical tastes and you were exposed to them.
Absolutely. A gospel. And now, of course, that kind of connects to this project with the Dvorak project, right? Because it's about spirituals and the involvement of spirituals and the suggestion, or actually the contention, that it is a real form, a classical form, I mean, from our own musical tradition. I like pop music. I mean, if you listen to me driving over here today, the car's kind of thumping with the bass music of some R&B music, and I really enjoy it, but my voice was never suited to it. And gospel, in the same way, there's a kind of visceral energy that one sings with when you're singing gospel music. And my voice just kind of wasn't built for that.
So who did you turn to as, I mean, you had Mr. Kaplan is a conductor inspiration, yes, but as vocal mentors, and has that changed at different points in your career? Who did you look to?
It was Leontine Price, really? I just have to say. You know, interesting that it's dramatic soprano, yeah, spinto soprano. But when I was in the choir at Fort Dix, there was this wonderful woman, I can't remember her last name, but her first name was Diane, and she saw that I had this burgeoning interest in classical singing and opera, and she came into one rehearsal on a Thursday night and said, Kevin, I want you to listen to this. And she gave me an Aida recording with Leontine, and it blew me away. And, I mean, all the other, there was a wonderful cast of singers, like Giorgio Tozzi, who was a fantastic bass, and may have been either Vickers or Domingo on one of these earlier recordings. The whole operatic world just opened up to me, and I thought, well, the difference between oratorio and opera is that you really get to hear these singers sing extended arias and have dramatic moments, and I thought, well, that's just more of a good thing in terms of listening to opera.
But there's nobody in your vocal range?
Yes, there are. She was my, you know, muse that brought me to the art form. But Paul Robeson and William Warfield, and I mentioned Giorgio Tozzi. I loved Walter Berry, the great Austrian or German baritone. And since then, many, many more. Ren Terfel, I'm a big fan of his, even though he's younger than I am. I still look up to him for his dramatic and vocal presence, his power. Mm-hmm. Heard him do a recital at Carnegie Hall, and it was almost an hour and a half of singing, and he just got stronger and stronger, and the expression was so much there. So I'm a fan of many great. Hans Hotter is another wonderful, great bass. And
Christoph Kipnis.
In fact, I met Alexander Kipnis before I went to Juilliard. Mm-hmm. My teacher suggested that I go and sing for someone who was connected to the faculty. Kipnis had left Juilliard, but I went to his house with my dad, had no idea what history I was sitting in front of. I mean, I was 17 years old.
Wow.
And he was just lovely, and he said, Kevin, you will get into Juilliard, and I suggest that you work with Hans Heinz, who's one of the more musical teachers at Juilliard. And so, very impressed with that voice.
Singing the role of the angel Raphael in Franz Joseph Haydn's oratorio The Creation, here is my guest Kevin Dace with Boston Baroque, led by Martin Perlman, in the aria Now Heaven in Fullest Glory Shine.
Alles nicht vollbracht, doch vor noch alles nicht vollbracht. Den ganzen fehlte das Geschöpf, das Gottes Werke dankbar sind. Es wären Güte
For this voice, put aside one specific opera lead role, which we're going to talk about separately. Mm-hmm. Put that aside. Mm-hmm. Our audience may not know what a bass baritone voice, what the landscape is. Now, you mm-hmm. mentioned Messiah, and there was, mm-hmm. oh, yes. Well, name some things that you have to know or that constantly creep up in your career. That's just the basics, the meat and potatoes of being a bass baritone.
Well, for me, I kind of built my classical singing on Bach. My voice is well suited to Bach. I have a pretty comfortable time with coloratura. And there was something that touched me. Maybe it was just my upbringing, being around religious music and singing hymns and that kind of thing, and the chorale melodies. I would say Bach is a basic kind of basis for my classical singing. And then sung a lot of Mozart as well. But most of the music I've sung has been early and or contemporary music. Right. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of Handel operas, and I premiered a lot of pieces in the concert world with Dave Brubeck, but also on the operatic stage with music from Anthony Davis and these composers. And so there's kind of a gap there. I'd love to fill it in with Verdi and more of those kind of big romantic roles, but it's been principally early and contemporary.
And if it's the Baroque opera, more times than not, you're the bad guy.
Exactly. It's very rare that the baritone is kind of, the bass baritone is a romantic lead. He's usually the father. I was actually drawn very early on. I did a competition in New Jersey just out of high school where I sang Iago's Credo from Otello. Now, at the time, I had no idea that that would completely destroy the conflict of the opera if you had a black Iago.
Right.
Because his whole position is that, you know, Otello is not quite human because of his blackness.
Reminds me of Bernstein's last and only recording of West Side Story, where Kiri Takanawa was Maria.
Right,
like,
it doesn't work.
It's
incongruous, you know. And I know that in opera, one is meant to suspend disbelief.
True.
But that would have been a real challenge, you know. I don't know how I could have ever sung the role of Iago, not to mention that it actually sits too high for me, ultimately. Yeah. But I love that aria.
From the oratorio-esque piece by Hannibal Lacumba, with words by the composer and reflecting on the great civil rights activist Rosa Parks, the work called Dear Mrs. Parks. Here is the Detroit Symphony Orchestra and Rackham Symphony Choir, led by Thomas Wilkins, and my guest today, bass baritone Kevin Dace, in Seeds of the World.
Upon the land where they lived. trees did not hold our bodies like pendulums in the wind. So broken and unconfessed before our mothers and our God.
How many times have you sung Porgy in your career?
Oh gosh, I would say well over 100, maybe hundreds, you know. I toured with this group called the New York Harlem Productions, and they would tour mostly in Europe. In fact, I've never sung a staged version of Porgy in America, but I've done it in a lot of the major houses in Europe.
Right.
The music is beautiful.
Yeah.
And I know that a lot of my colleagues avoid Porgy because you become typed.
Well, that was my question.
Yes.
I mean, this is a great American opera.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted to ask you about, and you're the perfect person to ask, because it seems from this viewpoint, which could be wrong, let me say, that it's a plus and a minus. The plus is great opportunity and great specialization.
That's right.
The minus is stereotyping and typecasting.
That's right.
So walk us through that tightrope.
Well, fortunately for me, I had established myself as a concert singer prior to doing these Porgy performances.
Okay.
So it wasn't the first thing that casting members thought of. On the other hand, I think every singer or at least I'll say most singers, are grateful for having a role that acts as a vehicle to keep them in the business, to keep them busy and active. And so it really is fine with me. Some of my friends feel a little, another porgy, and I'm like, no, don't feel that way. You know, I have colorateurs who are like, oh, another queen of the night, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, and then other colleagues who aren't working. So it really isn't, for me, a problem that porgy is a part of my musical life. It's very challenging, of course. You know, the productions that I do are really more authentic. They're a bit more like the original Houston opera production. So I'm on my knees for about 2.5 hours. It's physically grueling.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, when I go into the next production and I'm thinking about the physical challenge that's required, it concerns me right up until the point where the music starts to play, where Porgy is about to enter the stage. And there's no questioning the adoration that George Gershwin felt for Porgy. He loved Porgy. And suddenly I forget that I'm on my knees and that they hurt, maybe. And I'm suddenly in this role that is just enveloped in Gershwin's love.
This is a dumb question. You wear knee pads, right?
Oh, absolutely. And we're in a good time now because of inline skating and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
There are really good knee protectors with gel pads and things like that.
It's going to massage your knees as you do the part.
Exactly.
You mentioned that Houston Grand Opera, and really it was that performance that told Americans, wake up, this is an opera.
Yes.
Not just a trove of great tunes.
That's right.
Has the European audience always embraced this as an opera? Or, I mean, what's the reaction from the European audience?
You know, it's always positive.
Yeah.
And I think, in a way, they're less concerned about its legitimacy as a grand opera than we are here in America. Mm. I think in America, when I do Porgy performances here, again, mostly concert versions, shorter and longer concert versions, the critics spend like a third of their review questioning its legitimacy.
Yeah.
And the thing is that in terms of what's required physically, you could ask anyone who's ever sung Porgy, it requires a developed classical technique, vocal technique, and you are singing operatically. One teacher I had said it's like Votan on your knees.
Yeah.
But again, it's the music that carries you away. And,
right. I mean, it's 80 years now. I think we're past
I wonder, America, and again, we talk about this in the Dvorak in America project, that anything that relates too directly to American culture is a little bit suspect.
So here, recorded live in concert, is my guest Kevin Dace as Porgy, with Julianne Green as Bess, and Valentin Radu conducting the ensemble Vox Amadeus, Bess, You Is My Woman Now, from George Gershwin's Porgy and Bess.
Oh,
last week, my cadenza guest was Joseph Horowitz. And Mr. Horowitz, of course, besides being one of the great American historians and writers, really has a passion and a knack for reinventing the concert experience for people.
Yes.
Now, he's been doing this for well over a decade now with the Post-Classical Ensemble.
Yes.
You are one of the people that he loves to program for. So, I mean, we talked a little bit about the Dvorak last week, but he's on to so many other projects. He's doing the Mexican Redis with Rick Vueltas, all this kind of stuff. So, talk about some of the projects you've done with Post-Classical and just, you know, what they've meant to you, but also what happens during these performances and afterwards.
You know, when I first met Joe, I was a little skeptical. You know, I wasn't sure exactly what this was all about. I came from a really kind of traditional classical career. I mean, that's kind of how I've lived my life. And so when he introduced this whole idea of a melodrama and then making this point about Dvorak's intent on making the American musical tradition the basis of the classical music tradition, a new classical music tradition, you know, it was all very new to me. But I'll tell you, when you talk about maybe my dramatic presence, this has done a lot to evolve that. When you don't have music to rely on, it is only text. I mean, it's a melodrama, so I'm accompanied by music, so everything I say is within the context of what's going on musically, but I'm not singing much. And it's been a great exercise because you just look at the words and you communicate the great Wadsworth Longfellow text.
Right.
And I feel so blessed to have that experience. And then I did a recital, an interesting program down at the Brevard Center a few weeks ago. And we did both the Dvorak in America, and I also did a recital. And it had been a while since I'd actually done a recital. And I found that my expressivity has grown, and I can directly credit that to the melodrama experience.
But some of the other things you've done with him or are doing with him are wide-ranging. I mean, talk about the Bach.
Yes.
This has nothing to do with America.
Nothing at all. I mean, God bless Joe. He asked me if I would sing Ich habe genug with the Post-Classical Ensemble in Washington at an old church. I can think of the name of it right now, and it was one of the most amazing experiences. The audience basically sat in the round. I was in the middle of the church, just an open floor space there, and there I was with the orchestra, and just to myself singing Ich habe genug, which was one of the first pieces that I'd ever heard, a whole cantata, basically, that's written for bass. My dad, actually, is part of his therapy being in Vietnam, he would record classical recordings. So when I was in high school, I actually came across a recording of Dieskau singing Ich habe genug. And so it's always been one of my favorite. And Joe's been very, very generous. I've told him so on many occasions, scheduling these performances. And he's got a wonderful relationship with the National Cathedral. And this year I'll sing Messiah at the National Cathedral, and also a new program that he designed called The Trumpet Shall Sound. And in that we'll be doing, of course, the Handel aria from Messiah, as well as spirituals, going back and forth from spirituals to classical music, which is pretty much my life these days.
And I know his mind is working, whether you guys have talked about ideas or whether you throw ideas at him, but there's other things that are going to come down the pike here.
It's really collaborative. We're working on something in Mexico for next year. He's a brilliant man. We also do another program called Deep River, which is much more specifically about spirituals, of course.
I didn't have this down. Just a quick question about spirituals. I think they're the first great body of American music that is recognized as American.
Yes.
They were.
Yes.
The first body of music that goes internationally as solely American and appreciated such.
That's right.
I guess the question is that over the decades now, people, I don't want to say the appreciation has gone up for spirituals, but the idea, the recognition of how important they are rather than just fillers at the end of a recital.
Yes, yes.
Have you seen that? I mean, because you've performed them a lot. And
I do, and it's kind of almost an awkward experience when there are a lot of black people in the audience, my African-American countrymen. They have mixed feelings, you know, because they think it somehow romanticizes the slave experience. And that's, of course, not all of my African-American friends have that reaction. But I find that especially the Burley arrangements have such dignity and presence in them that, you know, it's not at a loss for anything in terms of musical expression. It's really rich repertoire. But again, some of my friends and some of my white friends react to it as well. It's kind of, you know, the language and, you know, how they use the dialect and the text, and they think it's a little maybe demeaning or somehow. And I just think, again, in Burley's case, it's quite authentic.
And just the whole history of them and what they meant to various sections of either the slave population, if it was prior to that time, or how they transitioned out. And that's, I mean, right. It's fascinating stuff.
It really is.
It's fascinating body music. Much more than other American musics. I mean, yes. The blues is the blues and jazz is jazz, yeah. But the spirituals have a fascinating history.
And that's what they evolved out of, blues, right. and jazz. You know, yeah. it came from that spiritual tradition, but somehow they kind of want to lose the source and the way they promote it, you know, but that's an actual fact.
From Dave Brubeck's massive cantata, The Gates of Justice, composed after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., to bridge the Jewish and African-American cultures together, drawing texts from sources such as the Psalms and the Union Prayer Book, is my guest Kevin Dace singing When I Behold Thy Heavens.
When I behold thy heavens, the works of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast established, what is man?
What is man?
Thou art mindful of him, and the Son of Man. Thou thinkest of him, yet thou hast made him but little lower than the angels, and hast crowned him.
Mention also that you don't shy away from new music. You've done works by really important composers, good friend of the station. You've done Derek Bermel's music.
Yes.
You've done Hannibal Lecumberland's music.
Yes.
You said how you worked with great artists and composers in other genres, Dave Brubeck, for example.
Yes.
What do you get out of doing new music and the challenge of that? And are composers up to writing for the bass voice? I know it sounds like a weird question.
I don't know that anyone's up for writing for the bass voice. You know, when I get scores and I look and it starts at a middle C and up, and I'm like, why can't you write?
Yeah, upside down, you turn the score up.
Then it's fine, you know. But, yeah. But the way that it's set up, you know, I think it's a tough voice to kind of write for in some ways.
Right.
Because, you know, audiences like a dramatic high note. They want sounds that seem like they're kind of pushing the edge of the voice, and they're excited by that. I mean, your ability to do that well is very exciting. But for most, especially with my experience, modern composers, They may have the right intent when they start intention by writing kind of a nice low tessitura, but sooner or later it shifts up and wants to stay there. That's where the baritone of my bass baritone comes in handy, because at least I do have that extension on the top where I can sing some of the higher notes.
But on the whole, the new pieces you've done over the last decade, two decades, they've been enriching experiences. They haven't turned you off from...
Oh, not at all. I mean, Hannibal's music is beautiful.
Yeah.
Anthony Davis's, it was very intelligent music. And also, I like to think of myself as a musician singer. I've always had envy for, like, amazing pianists and, you know, other instrumental players. When I was in high school, I would have loved to have been in the band or played in an orchestra, because in a certain way, the bar is set a little lower in choral music. And I aspired to have just be as good a musician as anyone playing in an orchestra. And so it satisfies me to be able to prepare a modern work, a complicated work. It's very gratifying. And the only time I really got scared was doing this Elliot Carter piece called Syringa, which looks like syringe, which was something I thought I might need to use to get through that engagement, because it was so hard. It was in Greek, completely atonal, and I did it with the wonderful mezzo Mary Nessinger, who's a real specialist, and even she was concerned about syringa. But it was just keep at it. I just love the feeling of working on something and getting it to where it needs to be. And Carter was at the performance.
I was going to say, he had to be, since he lived 105. He had to be at the performance.
He was there, and he thought it was one of the better performances of the work at the end. But I've never been more intimidated by a work than that.
You shall hear how Paupu Kiwis danced at Hiawatha's wedding. First he danced a solemn measure, treading softly like a panther. Then more swiftly and still swifter, whirling, spinning round in circles, leaping o'er the guests assembled, heading round and round the wigwam, till the leaves went whirling with him like great snow drifts o'er the landscape.
So back to the work my guest has been doing with the Post-Classical Ensemble, led by Ángel Gil Ordóñez, from a recording called Dvorak and America, and the work put together by Joseph Horowitz and Michael Beckerman called Hiawatha Melodrama, designed to show the link between Dvorak's famous New World Symphony and the Longfellow poem The Song of Hiawatha, which Dvorak said had inspired him in composing the symphony. Here's the movement I played a bit from last week in its entirety, Hiawatha's Wedding Feast. The voice, that of my guest today, bass baritone Kevin Dace.
Then the gentle Chibiabos sang in accents sweet and tender. On away, awake, beloved. Thou the wild flower of the forest, thou the wild bird of the prairie. Thou with eyes so soft and fawn-like, if you only look'st at me, I am happy. I am happy as the lilies of the prairie when they feel the dew upon them. On away, awake, beloved. And among the guests assembled at my Hiawatha's wedding sat the marvelous storyteller. And they said, O good Iagoo, tell us now a tale of wonder. And Iagoo answered straightway, You shall hear the strange adventures of Osio, the magician. Once in days no more remembered in the Northland lived a hunter, with 10 young and comely daughters. All these women married warriors. Only Oweeni, the youngest, laughed and flouted all her lovers, and then married old Osio. Old Osio, poor and ugly. But Osio was transfigured,
was restored to youth and beauty, but alas for good Oseo, and for Owini the faithful, changed into a weak old woman. Then a voice was heard, a whisper coming from the starry distance. Oh, Oseo, broken are the spells that bound you. Then the lodge began to tremble, and they felt it rising slowly through the air, ascending from the darkness of the treetop forth into the dewy starlight. And behold, the wooden dishes all were changed to shells of scarlet. And behold, the earthen kettles all were changed to bowls of silver. All the sisters and their husbands changed to birds of various plumage. Some were jays, some were magpies, others thrushes, others blackbirds. And they hopped and sang and twittered, pecked and fluttered all their feathers, and their tails like fans unfolded. Then returned the youth and beauty of Owini the youngest, and her staff became a feather, yes, a shining silver feather. Such was Hiawatha's wedding, such the dance of Paupukiwis, such the story of Iagu, such the songs of Chibiabos. Thus the wedding banquet ended, and the wedding guests departed.
We are sitting here talking at the George School in Newtown. You teach some vocal students here, which are students who in all ranges and ideas of what they want to do with their voice. Still teach at Princeton?
Yeah, I just returned this past fall. Yeah.
I ask many performers this, why teach? What does it give you? What do you get out of teaching? Because some performers can't go.
That's right. Well, I've always loved teaching. I started teaching right after I graduated from college. Within a year, I was already teaching at Wilkes University, Wilkes College back then. And it's always something I've really enjoyed and feel that I have a special gift in doing. Maybe the reason I have such a wide range of students and interests is because I don't have a specific agenda for any student. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I hear qualities in their sound that suggest the potential as a classical singer, I do everything I can to encourage it. But as a teacher, I feel as if the student should convince me that this is something they should pursue. It's such a difficult business. Every year, there are tens of thousands of voice majors graduating from colleges around the U.S. and countless around the world for very relatively few opportunities to perform, and maybe even less likely to have a career. So the only students I kind of coax into pursuing performance is because they are so committed and they've convinced me that it's worth my encouraging that pursuit.
So you're not teaching the conservatory mold, you're teaching more towards what's the opportunities and possibilities for any particular singer.
That's right.
And I mean, that's all over the map.
You know, in time, I'm sure I'll end up at a conservatory. I nearly took a position up at the Longy Institute up in Boston this year. There were some logistical issues in terms of accepting it. I would like to work with students who are that specific in their interest, and that time will come. And you never know. I mean, there have been a couple of students I've worked with here at George School who have decided to pursue. And so I am getting that experience, you know.
Well, our listeners hopefully will get to hear you in these collaborations with Mr. Horowitz as we're going to partner with them and bring some of the post-classical ensemble things to broadcast. So we'll get to hear you, hopefully in the Dvorak and hopefully in the Bach. And
yes.
But anything ahead in the next year so that you're really looking forward to?
You know, I love my life right now. I love the teaching that I'm doing, and I'm working as a performer, enough performances to keep things interesting. a nice range of repertoire still, doing Rachmaninoff the Bells with Joanne Folletta, who I adore, by the way.
So do we. She's great part of the station.
I just love her.
Yeah, she's great.
And I'm actually doing 3 engagements with her this next season, the Verdi Requiem, the Bells, and there's a 3rd one which is escaping me right now. But I was with her just in Brevard as well this summer. I'm doing I'm doing with Buffalo, we're doing Belshazzar's Feast.
Ah, okay.
And so I just love that piece too. Yeah. I'll be doing Elgar's Dream of Gerontius down in Florida with the Jacksonville Symphony. And so these are kind of highlights. And but it's nice and steady and a nice diverse repertoire that I'm performing.
Well, we look forward to any opportunity to hear the voice. I close all my cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same 2 questions. And the first question is a hypothetical, which says, if you could chat, like we've been doing, with someone from the past, someone you never had a chance to, but could talk with them, pick their brain, what's the first name that pops into your head?
Bach.
It would be Bach.
It would have to be Bach. I don't know what it is. I just love his music. I read The Learned Musician not long ago, Wolff's book.
Yeah.
And was just fascinated. You know, at 13 years old, he's climbing around in these organ lofts, you know, repairing organs. It sounded like someone working on a ship, you know.
Right.
I mean, just the way that he conceived the music that he wrote, and that no one else was even thinking in those terms. It would probably be Bach. First, and then I add another one, it might be Gershwin, but Bach is...
Well, it's funny with Bach, because Bach was a craftsman and wrote to need, so, you know, writing Habergenug, he had a bass who could do this.
That's
obviously,
right.
He wouldn't have written it.
That's right.
But I wonder if he'd heard a voice like yours, you know, would he have just... You know, the next 4 Sundays of cantatas would have had huge bass solos.
Yes. I mean, there's wonderful... Ich gerne of the Kreuzstab Tragen cantata.
Yeah.
Is another one that he wrote for bass that's also beautiful.
Yeah.
There was one experience I had. It was an odd season because I was in America singing Bach with Baldwin Wallace Bach Festival, as well as Winter Park Bach Festival. And right in the middle, I go to Leipzig to sing Porgy. And I always thought, what a wonderful sense of humor God has that, you know, I go to Weimar and I sing Porgy, and then I come back to America and sing Bach with Musica Sacra or something. You know, it's exciting. I love the mix.
See, that bass voice allows you to have those topsy-turvy moments, which no one else could do.
It's true.
There's no soprano that could say that. The final question's a non-musical question. Everybody interviewing cadenza fills their life with music. You're very busy.
Yeah.
When you have to step away from it, respite, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, something that can take you away from music when you need to get away, what do you do?
It's terrible. My dad was a really conservative Baptist, and I thought his life seemed so constrained in that one view of life. And I realize my life is even more orthodox than his. It's so much about music. Now, I love athletic activities. I'm a big fan of badminton, which I play with one of my best friends. And I love going out to the sea. I'll be going down to Sanibel Island in a couple of weeks and spending a week there on the coast. And I love to do that kind of travel. But it's very boring to say, but it's so much about music and friends who are also in music. And that's how I kind of do things, kind of obsessively that way.
Kevin Dace, thanks for taking some time.
David, so nice for you to have me.
Bass baritone Kevin Dace. You can find out more about him at his management's website, Dispecker Artists, at DISPEKER.com, and his recordings with the Post Classical Ensemble, such as the Dvorak and America, are available on the Naxos label at Naxos.com. I leave you with my guest performing his beloved Bach, the Bach aria Quia Fecit Mihi Magna. From Bach's setting of the Magnificat, Valentin Radu leads the ensemble Vox Amadeus, the voice, that of my guest today, Kevin Dace. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting and an exclusive production of The Classical Network and WWFM.org.
Todesfest et sanctum nomen eius et sanctum nomen et sanctum nomen eius sanctum.